Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBQ 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
And we are at the interview part of the show. So that's the exciting part, not listening to us. So now today we have another author and quite a history in writing. A lot of great books here. Mystery, fiction, fantastic. So our guest is Gregory Ash. Thank you for taking the time to come on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Wow, Greg. So you've written a lot of books. Where did it start for you? Like, what got you into writing to begin with?
Oh, man. Yeah, I think like a lot of writers, I wrote a lot when I was a kid, and then I had these relatives who, they were kind of like these disaster stories, like these warning stories, who had tried to be artists and who had ended up, you know, living in terrible conditions because of it. So I at some point I decided to be respectable and be an accountant, and I tried to do that for a while. And then in college, when I was doing that accounting degree, I realized that was a mistake. And so I went back to writing when I didn't go back until I was like 25 when I had, a teaching job. And I thought, well, you know, I can at least pay the bills. So now I can do this as kind of a hobby. And then, I just did it for, I wrote for about 10 years before I had some people, you know, get interested and start picking up my stuff. And so it was kind of a, for a long time, kind of a back burner thing, something that I enjoyed doing, but didn't trust to be a career, you know, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, story of my life.
No.
I'm still waiting.
Yeah.
Now, so when you started, like, how do you choose these themes that you choose in mystery or, as you call, speculation fiction? Like, where does the idea come from?
They come from all over the place. So I started my Hazard and Somerset books actually started because I was reading, I was watching Forensic Files, and, you know, there's this real case about a police officer who was having an affair with a young gay man and murdered him when his lover threatened to out him to the other police. And I thought, boy, that's a great story. Like, you know, talk about all the ramifications of that. So that's not the story I ended up telling, but that was kind of the seed for it. But in other cases, it's come from kind of real life connections. I have a paranormal YA series with a young man who's moved to Wyoming, and we had some family friends who went through a horrible divorce and took their family there, and the tragic, you know, short story version is that, you know, one of their children attempted to take their life by suicide, being isolated in this small town in the middle of nowhere. So, I mean, and anyway, so, like, there's a lot of things that just kind of stick with me and become, like, compelling. And I want to think about what that might be like or what it might mean. And so they just kind of linger, and I think I just turn them over until I have something to say about them.
So in a way, it's more about you're trying to put some sort of story across to the readers. Like you want them to get it's not just a total fiction.
Yeah, I think when at least the type of fiction that I enjoy isn't like a moralizing fiction. Like, it doesn't have a lesson maybe that you can point to, but it still might help you understand something about someone in a particular situation, and I think that understanding can be really significant. So usually, like, the aperture for me when I approach these is, like, what's the thing that I want to understand or that I want someone else to understand after they finish this book?
And that's interesting, because when you say that, when you want someone to get an understanding, or how do you develop these characters throughout the story when they're fictional like that? That's something I'm not sure about myself, because I deal in true crime, so I'm following what a character does. How do you actually how do you get into the development of it? And do you draw that from people you know?
Yeah, so let me ask you really quick. I've looked at some of your true crime writing, and I was curious, when you were doing that, and you're trying, I mean, at what level are you thinking about the psychology of those characters? Like, what level are you delving into that?
Oh, well, for me, I go as, well, I don't know. I think that I just portray as much as I can about the person. And for a real true life person, you have to get a lot of people involved in it. You know, you can meet them and talk to them, but I'm giving my perspective, but I need to go around them and get everyone's perspective, because the more I can do that, the more of a 3D image you get. And for me, I'm always looking at the whole process of what happened to everybody that's involved in the story, not just centered around, let's say, the criminal or the victim, but everyone else. It's a real ripple effect.
And I think that's so. John McPhee, who's, you know, this great nonfiction writer, he has this image about when he does a story about a person, it's, he says, you know, you've done enough interviews when you meet yourself coming and going, like you keep start running into the same people over and over again. And that's not quite the same with fiction, I guess, right? Like, you can't, there's no one to go interview. But I do think what you described, and I think what McPhee describes, this, if you could, like, this visual of the circle that you keep going around and around trying to see the person from different angles, I think that is true. I think there's, and I think with fiction, it's like an iceberg, right? You know, you see 10%, and the other 90%, if it shows up, you're in trouble, right? Like, you should sink below the waterline. Yeah. So, to answer your question, I guess there's a lot of thinking and researching. Like, I try to research, maybe not people that I know personally, but people that share some of the traits I'm interested in or circumstances I'm interested in. And then trying to find a way to make those cohere, I guess, to make those come together in a way that's new and unique for this character.
Yeah. Yeah, because I find if I'm writing about a true person, if I don't get different angles, you're not going to get a real perspective of that person. And a lot of, I think, true crime authors make that mistake. From what I see, for me, it's a mistake. Right. Maybe not for them, because someone will scream at me for that. But but what I mean is, like, I can take you for instance and say Gregory Ash. So I can go around your circle of friends and say, as a reporter, What do you think about Gregory? Is he funny? Is he smart? Is he like? Give me his character, and I can also go to people you worked with and people that have been with you, and you're going to get people that didn't like you, and this is why they didn't like you, or people that, oh, he's smart, but he's this, or he's this and that. So you get more of a 3D perspective of the person. So I think that's really important. I just think it's, I just don't know how you would do it with someone that you've totally created a character, like there's Joe Smith or whatever, and then I've got to develop this person. So how do I do that? That's what I find fascinating. I think that's an amazing thing to be able to do.
Well, thanks. I mean, I think in some ways what you're describing does, I would hope, plays out on the page in the sense that, like, I would like people to see these characters not through a chunk of exposition. He had brown hair and he had broad shoulders and she was smart as a whip, but through the things they do, and more importantly through the people they interact with, and the broader range, right, the broader that cast of characters, like maybe in the same way that you would be seeking out a broad range of people to interview about me, provide maybe that multidimensionality of the character, right? Like, he is let's say this character is Emery Hazard in these books, is kind of a jerk to most people until you see him, right, with this 2-year-old stepdaughter, right? And so, I mean, I think some of the dynamic that you're describing plays out in fiction, but in a very different way.
Greg, would you say that you mentioned that some of your inspiration, or at least seeds for inspiration, comes from life events, from people that you may know, or you see what people experience. Mm-hmm. Would you say that almost what you're trying to portray, you mentioned also about helping people understand something that's going on, a theme or an event, it's almost like presenting a documentary through a fiction book?
Boy, I hadn't thought of it that way, Julie, but that's a really thoughtful account of that process. I mean, I think that in the same way that, so I just watched The Tiger King. That's my immediate thought when you say how a documentary presents a story and maybe engages with a theme. I think there is some of that. I think that there's this sense that, you know, Flannery O'Connor has this amazing line, and I'll paraphrase it and I'll butcher it, but she says something like, if you can put the theme of a book into words, it wasn't a very good theme, right? Like, if you can boil it down to a sentence, it probably wasn't very good to start with. And that's a little tricky for me because I also am a full-time high school teacher. I teach English, and I have to make my students write these theme sentences. But I do think there's something to be said that, you know, the experience of a story, whether it's in a documentary, as you described, or whether it's in a novel, is itself the experience that I want people to have. That, like, maybe it's not reducible to a line in, like, a ledger entry or something like that. Am I answering your question or not really? I don't know.
Yeah, yes, you are. I think for me, it was about, if we're trying to help somebody experience and understand the situation, then we're putting a set of facts around it. This is what, you know, this is somebody's experience, or this is evidentially what we know about a scenario. Mm-hmm. And that becomes much more of a documentary.
Right.
So I quite liked the idea of having that documentary be set in a fictional setting,
so
educating through that way, using characters that, yes, you have to put that 3D approach to, you have to make them believable, so we have to feel like we know and we're living with them. But the idea of having that as a kind of a fictional documentary was good. I enjoyed that.
I appreciate the way that you phrase that's helpful for me, and that's clarifying to me to kind of think about it in that sense of, yeah, like, it is an assemblage of facts and realities that are then just kind of draped over a fictional, like, armature or something like that. They're kind of, I like that a lot. That's really thoughtful.
You better.
I quite liked the draped over a fictional armchair. I thought that was good. let's just turn this into the Mutual Appreciation Society, and we'll just get rid of Al for a moment.
I'm the star.
That's where you're going wrong. You know, those fictional writings. That's the problem.
So what do you get? Well, I was going to say, what do you get out of these people? But so when you're writing this fictional story and you're following this character, how does it change you? Does it affect the way you behave after you've written the book?
I would hope so. I mean, I would hope that. I mean, the answer is I want it to, and it doesn't always play out that way. So, like, I often write about people who are not like me and who are people that I don't entirely understand. So, you know, lately I've done a lot of research on, like, psychopathology and self-harm and PTSD. And, you know, like, I'm very happy and fortunate to not have to deal with any of those things. But I want to say that, like, writing about those things and delving into them and makes me more compassionate. And then I go into a room full of teenagers and I get real irritated real fast. So I don't know how much more compassionate I am after doing this. But I'm better informed and more thoughtful about some of these things from having dwelt in them, but you know, that's like one of the hardest questions I've ever got, Alan. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, I personally find every time, and I didn't realize that until probably just a book or two ago, when someone made a comment to me about something that I was doing or saying, how I was behaving, so to speak, and I realized that it was probably something I took from that research and so when you know, because each of these things affect you, like if you watched a documentary like The Tiger King, at the end of it it affects you, right? You kind of you know, whether you're throwing up or rolling your eyes or whatever you're doing, but it makes a change inside of us. I just think when you go to write after you've done something like that, you're writing from a different platform. So I'm just thinking that I just wonder, you know, because I don't, like, this is a whole new area for me, the fiction and all of this sort of stuff. So I just wonder if it's part of you or not.
I think that it is. I think that I would be hard pressed to say that I'm. Yeah, go ahead, Julie. Sorry.
Isn't this about our values more so? You know, it's if we're impacted by something, if we take something from an experience or a piece of research or a learning that we've done, every interaction we have with another person gives us an opportunity to reflect on our own values.
Absolutely.
And generally, if we're feeling uncomfortable with something, or it's because it doesn't sit with our value base.
Right.
And if we're feeling uncomfortable in the scenario and we start to think about what that was about, why did we act in a certain way? Why did we feel a certain way? Sometimes it's about that lack of understanding, and we take something from that and we hopefully become better or more empathetic individuals going forward, depending on the scenario. So I mean, that's what I think I took from what Al was saying, I think.
Well, I would agree with both of you. I think that's true. I'm thinking, you know, again, of kind of the themes that I tend to follow in this work. And a lot of, I mean, they're obviously personal. Like, I write the book because I care about it and because it's something that's touched a chord with me.
Mm.
And so maybe the qualitative change is more one of degree than anything else. Like, I think, I guess I'm going to stop right there, but that's kind of my initial thought on that question. That's another tough question.
This is no party here.
He's been making these up for days. You don't know how long it took him.
This is great.
Yeah, I can kill a man at 10 paces. So so now maybe kind of go over some of the series, like what you've been doing, just kind of a little rough format of what you've done. So that our listeners can get an idea of what they would be getting if they pick up one of your books.
Oh, sure, absolutely. So I have a set of books that is, they're called the Hazard and Somerset books. The main characters are Emery Hazard, John Henry Somerset. It's set in a small fictional town in Missouri, and they start off as they're both police detectives investigating murders in this small town. And they have a history where Emory Hazard was bullied for a long time by Somerset growing up, and now Hazard has moved back, and they're kind of forced to work together, and the relationship evolves from there. So that's one set, and then I have another set. Those books tend to deal a lot with kind of like the persistence of like the culture wars in the United States and what those look like in communities that aren't on the coast. So like what the culture wars look like in rural Missouri, and I live in St. Louis right now, you know, and grew up here, is really different from what it looks like maybe to people from outside the Midwest. And so thinking about the murders tend to investigate either suspects or victims who kind of give a way of looking at those conflicts, whether, you know, liberal versus conservative or gay rights versus the Christian right, things like that. I have another set of books called The Borealis Investigations. Those are a pair of best friends who are private investigators in St. Louis, and they're proud of owning the only LGBTQ private investigation agency in the city, which is kind of a fun conceit. One of the characters is like, he's still a virgin, which is an important part of the character in the first book. And someone wrote me and said, I think it's more believable that there's a 27-year-old virgin than that there's a gay investigation agency. And I thought, well, yeah, probably. But so those books tend to deal with questions about the LGBTQ community, and kind of, so they investigate cases that have to do with, you know, the LGBTQ community. And then I have a paranormal series set out in a fictional town in Wyoming. And those are the ones that have a lot more to do with mental illness and self-harm, and they have a supernatural element, and so they're still mysteries, but with the twist.
That's interesting. When you mentioned the occult or like a paranormal twist in Wyoming, does this come from some sort of belief in the paranormal? Do you have like some sort of history with that or an experience?
Oh, that's a great question. So I was raised in an extremely religious, extremely conservative family. So like for me, after coming out and kind of the fallout of that, like I've kind of just set all of those concerns to the side and just kind of neatly they've gone in the closet after I came out. And so I don't really have any belief in the occult or the paranormal or the supernatural or anything like that, but for these books, that was more of a way of getting into questions of like psychopathology and like empathy and compassion. And so they were kind of the decision to make the character something of a psychic was more about kind of the things that I was interested in investigating than like a genuine belief or anything like that.
So would it be fair to say then that if you aren't a believer in the occult or supernatural, mediumship, psychic, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
So would it be fair to say, Greg, that then your belief would be that those things, those premonitions, predictions, accounts can be accounted for by psychology?
Oh, that's a great question. I hadn't even really considered my answer from that angle. I think... I would say that I'm pretty agnostic on a lot of that stuff. Like, I just don't feel like I'm in a position to say that it can, that, oh gosh. I mean, I want to say yes because I'm a big believer in science.
We're not going without an answer.
I know, man. I'm gonna lean on the side of science and say probably, but I'm gonna leave myself like a 1% margin of wiggle room just in case.
Nice. I believe in both. So I think absolutely
you can,
we read body language all the time. So it's not a leap, is it, to think that with neuro-linguistic programming, being able to really understand people's very delicate body movements, even blinking, you know, the raising of a muscle, twitch, and how we then can question somebody and question in a way, maybe using something like, you know, motivation interviewing, that sort of thing, to really evoke a response, and then be able to formulate a view or a judgment from that response. I think that's very likely, and so I think I would probably sit right in the middle and believe both
that
can be done.
Well, and that's a great, your example is an excellent one for kind of pointing out how blurred it becomes. Yeah, I think that's a great way of thinking about that.
Maybe that's a theme for another book.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it would be.
Because that whole level of deceit from the psychologist or a...
Yeah. Well, and that's kind of like the cold reading people and mentalism, right?
Yeah.
Like they kind of access that at a conscious level or manipulate it at a conscious level.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there are thousands of people out there that manipulate it at a very subconscious level, they have no idea that that's what's even happening.
Yeah, that's a great idea for a character. That's wonderful. Yeah. Someone real awful. Yeah, I love it.
Maybe a president.
Well, oh my God.
Well, just saying. Like, no,
yeah,
no.
Yeah.
All your hate mail goes to Julie. She's Carol. Her, you know, you can tell she's from Alabama from her accent, right? We get people that actually say that, you know. So just, yeah, it's crazy. So,
yeah, oh, from the Seven States, me.
Yeah, that's, you can tell the twang. You know, I find
British
that
etiquette.
Yeah. What? So where do you draw from other writers? Do other writers influence you, and do you read a lot? And kind of does it help you get through when you do your own writing?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's certainly, I do read a lot. Like, I'm a big believer in, you know, there's a number of writers that have said this and bandied it around, and the one that I can think of off the top of my head is Stephen King, but I know there are others. And the advice is, if you want to be a good writer, you have to do two things, which is you have to read books and you have to write books. And that sounds real dumb until you start talking to other writers and find out how many of them haven't read a book in the last year. And it was just shocking to me. The more I talked to people and the more I found out how they were too busy to read. And I thought, wow. So I do read a lot. And then,
normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
And I would say, kind of thinking about inspiration and influence, yeah, I've really tried to pare down who I read so that I only read authors who I think I can learn something from. And that is not like a claim about my ability. It's more a claim about, like, I don't want to waste my time reading books that just aren't that good. And so, I feel like I really try to, because I think whatever you read kind of gets into your subconscious. Does that make sense? Like it kind of infects you. And so I do spend a lot of time reading, and, usually if I get inspiration from a book, I'll see something like, sometimes it's a technique. Like, right now I'm reading Adrian McKinty's, Sean Duffy novels, which are set in Ireland during the Troubles. And have you guys read them? Are you familiar with him?
No, I'm not.
No, I haven't.
They're fantastic. I mean, they're just so beautiful and well-written and smart and full of pop culture from the, like, late 70s and the 80s. And it's just, like, a ton of fun to read. But they're also really smart and complicated and political. And so, like, he has this great, like, throwaway paragraph, basically, that about, he's listening to the Protestant channel. Well, he's a policeman in Ireland, and in Northern Ireland, and it flips over the Catholic radio station, and he just juxtaposes it really briefly, like a couple sentences, but it's just like this wonderful, like, way of capturing all the tensions that are happening in Northern Ireland at the time. So things like that, where I'll see it and I'll just be so impressed and I want to, like, figure out how to do that myself because it was just so well executed. Like, those are usually the things that I take away with me.
So Al, note to yourself here, just cancel that order we just put in for Greg's books. This guy sounds really good.
He is. Julie, he's really good.
I'm only joking. So if one of our listeners was to go into a bookshop and there's a whole stand of books there.
Yeah.
How do they know what's a good book? What should they be looking for in a book? Do you think, what catches your eye, and what do you think people should be looking for?
So I guess I'll answer that in two ways, because I think everybody brings their own things that they want to a book. And I'll give an example of it. I had a friend tell me recently, so like a lot of my readers are crossover readers from the romance genre, because usually my books have a romance subplot. And he was telling me about this conversation he overheard from some romance readers who, every time they buy a new book, they buy it in ebook, and the first thing they do is they do like a search in the Kindle app to find synonyms of male body parts. And if they don't show up enough times, they return the book because they know it's not going to have what they want in it. And that is not my way of picking a book, but it's some way people's way of picking a book. You know, like, people want different things out of a book, and more power to them. Like, there are people writing those books and there are people reading them, and you should find the book that you want to read and enjoy it. And I think that's awesome. That's my first. That's like the first half. I guess the second half is, what do I like? I like I like really solid, like really tight prose, and I like characters who aren't perfect but who are trying to be good people for whatever that means to them. And I do like a good twisty mystery. Like, you know, I like one that I can't figure out on my own. Well, I mean, what do you look for?
Nudity.
Oh.
Well, I just gave you a tool, Al. Like, you just do control F.
No, but one of the very first books I had published by a publisher, they sent me a couple of covers, right? The illustration part, and you're choosing, and I took it to some friends over here that I know, and the guy, it's a couple, and this guy says, well, you know, it's okay, but it would look really good if it had something sexy on the cover, right? Like put like a red slipper or shoe or high heel shoes. Like he was throwing all these ideas, and this is my very. I've never worked with a publisher before in my very first book.
Yeah.
So I sent back to the illustrator and the publisher that some of my friends said that they'd like something sexy on there, like a shoe and heel. My God, you should have seen the bad responses I was getting. The illustrator was, rape is not sexy and all that. Oh, my God.
Oh.
I never got involved again. So I don't. I don't know. You know.
Wow. They were lucky they didn't look for your search engine. That was
Oh, no, I'm the good girl. So, I don't know. So no, I don't know what I'd look for. I haven't been in a bookstore so long, I couldn't tell you anyway. But Julie.
For me, see, I didn't read a lot either. The last thing I was reading, I like reading more factual, really, more biographies.
Yeah.
But that's I find it hard, probably just because of time, to immerse myself into a story.
Yeah.
So, and I think that's quite sad, really. Because when I was younger, I was an avid reader, and that I would spend hours and hours just ploughing through books.
Yeah.
So I think it's quite sad that when you get older, you sometimes lose some of that, which is a shame.
Well, and life changes, and there are obligations and demands. I mean, that's true.
But I bought a chair. I bought a chair recently that I've put. Don't laugh. This is real. I bought a chair. Because I just one single chair so that no one could sit next to me.
Yeah.
No one would go into my space. And if I wanted to sit there with a book by my French doors, that's exactly what I will do. And I have sat there and I have picked up a book, a biography, and read a couple. But that's my space.
That's great.
Because I wouldn't want it interrupted by somebody sitting near me.
Yeah, that's great.
The shopping catalogs are not a book. Fashion magazines.
It was not. You shush.
Well, for me, I like the audiobooks. I mean, I don't know if you do all of your books in audio, but I think audio is important because now at my age, and I've had cataract surgery, so now I'm listening to books like crazy. So I'm not really buying hardcover books anymore.
No, I think that's a big market, and I think, like, I always have one going on my commute, too. I guess I haven't had a commute for, like, 2 months because of the pandemic. But, yeah, I mean, that's just such a nice thing to have as an option.
A pandemic?
Yeah.
Oh, well, you said a nice thing to have. No, I was just wondering, does this whole thing for you, in the last couple of months and with all the shutdowns and the COVID and all this, you know, conspiracies and negative news and blah, blah, blah. Does it affect your writing or creative process in your writing?
You know, it has not really affected me, but I know that for a lot of people it has. I mean, I see this, I've heard this from a lot of friends and I've seen it on, you know, different media outlets, you know, like ways to jumpstart your creativity if you're struggling right now. But I'll also admit that I am a fairly like cloistered person. Like I live my little life by myself. I don't read a lot of news or watch a lot of news. I get my, you know, I do my due diligence once a day to make sure I know what's happening in the world, and then I kind of move on. So maybe it hasn't infiltrated my life. I'm also a homebody by nature, so like it hasn't been too taxing to hang out at home. Mm. It's kind of my dream, actually.
It's living the dream.
That's right.
I agree. I'm more of a homebody, too. But I think that I feel like a dark cloud. I don't feel like writing anything in a positive light. Everything has it has kind of a dark feeling toward. So I'm not sure. I just wondering if it would influence you if you were doing a book, if you look at things from a darker side, you know?
I think that's a good question. The book I'm working on right now was already by nature pretty dark, so it's hard to know if that was coincidence or not. Like, it's kind of like a paranormal story that also kind of explores post-traumatic stress disorder. So, I mean, it was already pretty dark. I mean, it probably is a little darker than it would have been, but, and I think I took your question to be more about productivity and, like, staying focused.
Well, for me, yes, in the sense that, because whenever I'm going to complete a book, I go away. I have to get away from the house. I have to get away from everything going on in the house.
Where do you go?
go to hell? No, I am. Well, actually, to be honest, I pick usually a city that I don't know, and I go right to the downtown. I want at least 1 million or 2 million people. And I get a hotel, and then it isolates me in a crowd.
Stop that.
No. Yeah, and then in the hotel, then I get on the app sites. For me, I mean, I have to be isolated around a lot of people I don't know. Like when you're walking down a busy street in downtown and you see 1,000 people doing all their stuff and you don't know any of them, there's a certain type of isolation that creates, and that puts me in the mood. When you're at home, you've got, you know, the phone ringing, you've got the neighbors, you've got this, you've got the dogs, you've got all these things pulling at you. So it breaks your thought. Like, I mean, not for you, obviously, you're all alone and a hermit, right? So that's not an issue, right?
This show is so full of compliments.
You know, it's, you know, you got a bottle and whatever, but, you know, so, you know, today I'll open my blinds. No, I just, it all works for everybody, but just for me.
I'm not sure this is how Greg wanted to be portrayed.
And here, the outsider is real bleak. I'm not.
Well, people are overrated anyway, so, you know, you go out. You know, but now with the pandemic, there's no cities and there's no people, so there's no place to go. And plus, there's not really anything going on, so I'm sort of stuck right now. But
wait, so when you go to another city, are you revising at that point, or are you like literally typing the last chapters? Like, what's the finishing stage that you have to be away for?
Well, no, it's the I have 6 or 7 books going all the time, and Well, the reason is because you're doing investigating, so you have to meet the killer or meet the families and go get the court documents, meet police. So you have set up these appointments. You can't just do it all at once. It can take a couple of years. So you have all these going at the same time, and so that you always have something to do, you know, for one book or the other, back and forth. This is when everything's completed, when you have all your information and there's nothing else you really need to do. It's almost like then you put the voice to it.
Oh.
There has to There has to be the character voice that starts telling you the story from the beginning to the end. And that's kind of that's the part that I need to write when I'm away, because you have to be in the right atmosphere for that. For me, anyway, that's how it works for me.
That's fascinating. Julie, are you a writer too?
No, I'm not. I'm just amazed that somebody called you cool, Al. I've just taken that in. Hang on, I've got to put this on some sort of badge.
No, I think that's fascinating, Al. I'm not a nonfiction writer, so like to me that's just such a cool process.
I work in social work. I work with children and child protection.
Wow, that's amazing. Thank you for doing that.
It's very different than traveling around finishing a book.
Amazing service. That's awesome.
Yeah. Somebody's got to do it. Somebody's got to do the hard work so that I can sit around.
Oh man!
Yeah, that's how I see it, Al. That's how I see it.
So someone's got to pull the weight, right? No, it's an unusual process with writing, right? And you know that yourself. It's just an unusual process, and if things are not set to how it's going to work, it's going to work. And I'm a particular sort of person, so I'm kind of weird.
But I think whether you're writing because you're writing a complete works, as in a book, a novel, etc., or whether you're report writing, I think whenever you're concentrating on something that means you're offering an analysis, you're having to really think things through. Everyone's got a preferred style and where they do that. For me, I struggle with, at the moment in the pandemic, we're home working. So I would normally have take myself off to a quiet place to punch out a report. Mm-hmm. Whereas at the moment, I'm finding that much more difficult. My head's not really in it. And it feels very much like I'm having an excitable day working at home, which is a real treat. Mm-hmm. So your psyche is still set up for, this is brilliant, I'm at home and I can potter and I can do the odd bits, and then when I get into the office my head is down. So having to change your psyche to adapt to those different working styles is quite tricky.
Need
some wine.
I don't need a hotel.
Oh, well, it has to be a nice hotel.
I haven't asked for a hotel.
Well, you've got to start asking. You'll never get it if you don't ask, right?
Yeah, and I'm sure the local authority council budgets will say, off you go. That's fine.
Oh, come on. Just ask for it.
The taxpayer's purse. No, I don't think I need that. But I do understand the need for a particular place, and then that's where your focus comes in.
Yeah. Now, what have you you've got going here, Greg? You've got like this serial novel. So, what is that all about?
Well, I had written this novel, and it's set in that same town that I mentioned, that same fictional Missouri town, but it's set kind of as a few years before my main series of novel takes off. And I didn't really know what to do with it. Like, I was kind of sitting on it and thinking about it, but I was happy with the draft. It was just kind of a question of how to publish it or when to publish it. So when the shelter-in-place orders started becoming, not quite universal, but closer to it, a lot of authors were giving away their books or trying to find ways to provide people with, you know, content, entertainment during the time people were stuck at home. So I decided to serialize it, and I've been sending out a chapter every day for almost a month now. It's almost a month to the day now. So anyway, it's just been a fun, I've been surprised at how many people enjoy getting a chapter every day. Like, and then I'll also get the occasional email that tells me how frustrated they are. They want to read ahead, you know, now. But it's been kind of fun to kind of play it out more slowly like this.
That's interesting. So how do they get it? If they want to get that or catch up with you on that, what do they
get? Yeah, if they want to catch up, I have almost all of the chapters that have come out archived on my website. My website is my name, www.gregoryashe.com. And they can go there. It's called The First Quarto, which is because they're at a college, and one of them is a Shakespeare grad student, you know, so he's reading King Lear while he's solving a murder mystery, and which is how I wish my grad school had been, I think. And so they can find the novel there. There's also a link there to sign up for the remaining emails that will be coming out.
And what's in the future for Gregory? Like, where do you want to go with writing? Do you want to keep doing these types of series? Do you want to do something different? Do you want to expand? Like, where do you want to go?
That's a great question. I don't have a 5-year plan, but I have a 1-year plan. So I'm trying to think a little bigger and think about what I want this career to look like. I mean, the next set of books that I'm going to write. I've kind of explained how they all kind of deal with different kinds of issues. The next ones are going to be about the intersection and kind of the conflict of religion and the LGBTQ community. And so, that's just another area that's kind of, I think, rich for exploration and is obviously personal for me and something I've read about a lot and thought about a lot. And so, that'll take me through probably the next year working on those books. There's three books that I'm going to write for them. So, mystery is really the genre that I identify with and that I feel drawn to. And so I imagine like that'll be where I continue to build the career. But I got to keep planning. I don't have a plan beyond that part right now.
I find that interesting. So now the U.S. is really struggling with rights between the gay and the Christian and all that stuff. Do you think it's going to get better? Like, this is kind of an unusual switch for what's been going on the last little while. So does this sort of spark you to write these kinds of books?
Yeah, I mean, it is like so the question of LGBTQ rights is really fascinating because it's probably in the history of the United States, the issue that has seen the most drastic reversal, right? Like, it went from like 60% opposed to 60% in favor in a very short, I'm talking about right there, marriage equality, but like people like reversing their position drastically and in a really short matter of years, you know, not like the generations that other social issues have had to pass through and we still struggle with today. But like religion, it's just so hard because, man, I guess to be a little skeptical, there's so many people with power, there's so many people with power and like they're not eager to give that power up and they're not eager to, like, some of that power comes from being able to mark out people as like other and not good. And so I guess I think there are a lot of people trying to make it better, and I think there's a lot of institutional and systemic things in place that will make it hard to see those changes.
Yeah, I see a lot of struggle in the U.S. It's kind of a scary thing in a sense to see things that you think were resolved and they're not.
Well, and it's scary to see that. This is the most recent survey I saw was probably for 2 years ago. I think it was for 2018, but it was the first time in, I can't remember how many years, 10 years or 15 years or something, that youth in the United States were less tolerant of the LGBTQ community. And so like there was actually like this slippage, like losing ground among young people, which was really, like, to me, it was really disheartening. Like, I mean, these kids are growing up in a world where I think there's a lot more support than there used to be, and then to see a reversal is really discouraging.
Why do you think that is? Now, that seems to be, America seems to be having the largest, definitely the most vocal issue with it. So why do you think that is?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the study suggested that it's because youth in the United States, like this Gen Z, are just having less personal interaction in general, and that contributes to less, the thing that builds tolerance, of course, is meeting and knowing people who are not like you, but coming to understand them, and that like the invasion of devices and screens has made that actually for the first time less likely to happen for these young people because, you know, they're sitting at home with their phone instead of going out and meeting people. I don't know if that's entirely true. I mean, that's one of the things the study suggested, but I think you could say a lot about our political climate right now and the things that have been championed and have seen some success. You know, I think that could also help explain some of it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think the Trump and the right thing is just the right wing there. It's just something that represents the people, you know, a certain percentage of them. And he's just kind of brought it to the light and has the voice.
Yeah. But,
it's always been there, I think. So, that's a tough
one. Yeah, and I think you're right that it's always been there. And I think for a while we were able to tell a certain story in most media that a lot of those elements had disappeared or were dying out. And it's really upsetting to see them not only not dying out, but in some ways stronger than ever and legitimized and given a new public face. And I guess that's all I'll say about that.
Well, there we go. So now, any other information? Now, let's give out your website again and how people can find you.
Thank you. Yeah. My website is www.gregoryashe, and my last name is ashe.com. And I have that mailing list is on there, the first quarto. And then I'm also on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. And I try to be active, especially right now during the pandemic. Like, I have some extra time on my hands, so I try to engage with people and respond to people. So they can email me, track me down on my website, find me on Facebook. Yeah, I'm here. Available.
Doing TikTok videos?
I had a student ask me to be in one, and I very politely said no. Maybe not that politely. I thought I was polite.
Oh, I know, it's crazy. But, you know, that's the world we live in now. So
that's right. You know. That's right. 30 seconds or whatever it is.
Well, fantastic. Yeah, you know, so what we've done is we will have your website up on our website, so people listening to the show, if they want to find out more or if they want to send some hate mail, they can just do one click and find you. They can do it while they're listening. That's we are about convenience and helping people out, you know.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. I appreciate that.
Yeah, not a problem. And our guest has been author Gregory Ashe. Now, thank you for being on the show.
Thanks, Alan. Thank you, Julie.
Thanks, Gregory.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.